Eleanor Roosevelt became a major figure in American politics in her own right, just at a time when women were entering political parties. It was out of frustration with the major parties of Asians on equal rights that Alice Paul had founded the National Woman's Party in 1916. Fearful that soon-to-be enfranchised female voters would form their own voting bloc, the Democratic and Republican parties had then begun recruiting women. The Democratic National Committee, or DNC, formed a women's division in 1917, and the next year, the Republicans did the same, the party chairman pledging to check any tendency toward the formation of a separate women's party. After the ratification of the 19th Amendment in 1920, Carrie Chapman Catt, head of the League of Women Voters, steered women away from the National Woman's Party and urged them to join one of the two major parties, advising, "The only way to get things done in this country is to find them on the inside of the political party." Few women answered that call more vigorously than Eleanor Roosevelt, who became a leader of the Women's Division of the New York State Democratic Party while her husband campaigned and served as governor of the state. By 1928, she was one of the two most powerful women in American politics, head of the Women's Division of the DNC. Eleanor Roosevelt, lean and rangy, wore floral dresses and tucked flowers into the brim of floppy hats perched on top of her wavy hair, but she had a spine as stiff as the steel girder of a skyscraper. She hadn't wanted her husband to run for president, mainly because she had so little interest in becoming first lady, a role that, with rare exception, had meant serving as hostess at state dinners while demurring to the men when the talk turned to affairs of state. She made that role her own, deciding to use her position to advance causes she cared about, women's rights and civil rights. She went on a national tour, wrote a regular newspaper column, and in December 1932 began delivering a series of 13 nationwide radio broadcasts. While not a naturally gifted speaker, she earned an extraordinarily loyal following and became a radio celebrity. From the White House, she eventually delivered some 300 broadcasts, about as many as FDR. Perhaps most significantly, she reached rural women who had few ties to the national culture, except by radio. "As I have talked to you," she told her audience, "I have tried to realize that way up on the high mountain farms of Tennessee, on lonely ranches in the Texas plains, in thousands and thousands of homes, there are women listening to what I say." Eleanor Roosevelt not only brought women into politics and reinvented the role of the First Lady, she also tilted the Democratic Party toward the interests of women, a dramatic reversal. The GOP had courted the support of women since its founding in 1854. The Democratic Party had turned women away and dismissed their concerns. With Eleanor Roosevelt, that began to change. During the years when women were choosing a party for the first time, more of them became Democrats than Republicans. Between 1934 and 1938, while the numbers of Republican women grew by 400%, the numbers of Democratic women grew by 700%. In January 1933, she announced that she intended to write a book. "Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt, who has been one of the most active women in the country since her husband was elected president, is going to write a 40,000-word book between now and the March inauguration," the Boston Globe reported, incredulous. "Every word will be written by Mrs. Roosevelt herself." "It's up to the women," came out that spring. Only women could lead the nation out of the Depression, she argued, by frugality, hard work, common sense, and civic participation. "The really New Deal for the people," Eleanor Roosevelt always said, had to do with the awakening of women. 2. Franklin Delano Roosevelt rode to the Capitol in the back seat of a convertible, seated next to Hoover, a blanket spread across their laps. After that cold day, March 4, 1933, the two men never met again. "This great nation will endure as it has endured," FDR said in his inaugural address, attempting to reassure a troubled nation as he braced himself against the podium, bearing the weight of his body in great pain. "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself, nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror." At the time, many Americans believed that the economic crisis was so dire as to require the new president to assume the powers of a dictator in order to avoid congressional obstructionism. "The situation is critical, Franklin," Walter Whitman wrote to Roosevelt. "You may have no alternative but to assume dictatorial powers." Gabriel Over the White House, a Hollywood film co-produced by William Randolph Hearst and released to coincide with the March 33 inauguration, depicted a fictional but decidedly Rooseveltian president who, threatened with impeachment, bursts into a joint session of Congress. You have wasted precious days and weeks and years in futile discussions, he tells the assembled representatives. We need action, immediate and effective action. He declares a national emergency, adjourns Congress, and takes control of the government.
Mr. President, this is dictatorship, cries one senator.
Words do not frighten me, answers the president. Do we need a dictator? The nation asked the month the film was released and answered, emphatically not. Meanwhile, the world watched Germany. For a long time, American reporters had underestimated Hitler. Crackerjack world-famous journalist Dorothy Thompson interviewed Hitler in 1930 and dismissed him. He's inconsequent and voluble, ill-poised, insecure, she wrote. He's the very prototype of the little man. By 1933, what that little man intended was growing clearer, and Thompson would go on to do more to raise American awareness of the persecution of American Jews than almost any other writer. Nazism, she would describe, as a repudiation of the whole past of Western man, a complete break with reason, with humanism, and with the Christian ethics that are the basis of liberalism and democracy. Thrown out of Germany for her criticism of the Nazi government, she had her expulsion order framed and hung it on her wall. On January 30th, 1933, Hitler was appointed Chancellor of Germany. In parliamentary elections held on March 5th, the last vote the German people would be allowed for a dozen years, the Nazi Party narrowly failed to win a majority. 6 days later, Hitler told his cabinet of his intention to establish a Ministry of Propaganda. Joseph Goebbels, appointed as its head on March 13th, reported in his diary 4 days later that broadcasting is now totally in the hands of the state. Having seized control of the airwaves, Hitler seized control of what remained of the government. On March 23rd, he addressed the German legislature, the Reichstag, its doors barred. Speaking beneath a giant flag of a swastika, Hitler asked the Reichstag to pass a law to remedy the distress of people and Reich, essentially abolishing its own authority and granting to Hitler the right to make law. The government then outlawed all parties but the Nazi Party. By October, Germany had withdrawn from the League of Nations. Jewish refugees trying to flee to the United States found themselves blocked by a grotesque paradox. Nazi law mandated that no Jew could take more than $4 out of the country. American immigration laws banned anyone likely to become a public charge. To many people around the world, Roosevelt was the hope of democratic government, and his New Deal the last best hope for a liberal order. You have made yourself the trustee for those in every country who seek to mend the evils of our condition by reasoned experiment within the framework of the existing social system, John Maynard Keynes wrote to the president. If you fail, rational change will be gravely prejudiced throughout the world, leaving orthodoxy and revolution to fight it out. But if you succeed, new and bolder methods will be tried everywhere, and we may date the first chapter of a new economic era from your ascension to office. Keynes's expectations were nothing compared to those of ordinary Americans. In FDR's first 7 days in office, he received more than 450,000 letters and telegrams from the public. By no means was all the mail favorable, but FDR loved it all the same. It taught him what people were thinking. He made a point of reading a selection daily. People had been writing to presidents since George Washington was inaugurated, but by volume, no other presidency had come anywhere close. Hoover received 800 letters a day, FDR 8,000. The rise of fan mail, the expression wasn't used before the 1920s, was a product of radio. Radio stations and networks encouraged listeners to write to them and use their responses to refine their programming. In the 1930s, the National Broadcasting Corporation received 10 million letters a year, not counting mail sent to its affiliates, sponsors, and stations. Like radio stations, the White House began reading, sorting, and counting its mail. Eleanor Roosevelt received 300,000 letters in 1933 alone. The mail came pouring down on Congress next. By 1935, the Senate received 40,000 letters a day. By the end of the 1930s, voters were writing letters to Supreme Court justices. If FDR listened carefully to ordinary Americans by reading voter mail, he also assembled an altogether unordinary team of advisors. Elected during a national emergency, Roosevelt assembled a brain trust that included Frances Perkins as the Secretary of Labor, the first female member of a presidential cabinet. How he both relied on his brain trust and put his own touch on their advice suggested how he handled radio scripts. "We are trying to construct a more inclusive society," Perkins wrote for him in a draft of a speech he intended to give over the radio. When he delivered that speech, he said, instead, "We are going to make a country in which no one is left out." He began by shutting down the nation's banks. The rate of bank and business failures reached the highest point in history. Millions of Americans had lost every penny. The New York Stock Exchange and the Chicago Board of Trade had suspended trading, and the governors of 32 states had already shut their banks to prevent total collapse. In states where banks remained open, depositors could withdraw no more than 5% of their savings. Roosevelt shut the banks to prevent still further collapse. On March 5th, the day after he was inaugurated, he asked Congress to declare a 4-day bank holiday. Under the terms of the Emergency Banking Act, banks would be opened once they'd been found to be sound. On March 12th, FDR spoke on the radio in what radio executives took to calling a fireside chat, the first of more than 300. Explaining his banking plan, he offered reassurance. "I want to tell you what has been done in the last few days, and why it was done, and what the next steps are going to be," he said. He offered a lesson. "When you deposit money in a bank, the bank does not put the money into a safe deposit vault." He asked for Americans' confidence. "I can assure you that it is safer to keep your money in a reopened bank than under the mattress." Roosevelt's ability to take such measures was greatly strengthened by the popular endorsement he was able to secure by way of radio. People said that in the summer you could walk down a city street, past the open windows of houses and cars, and not miss a word of a fireside chat, since everyone was tuned in. "We have become neighbors in a new and true sense," FDR said, describing what coast-to-coast broadcasting had wrought. He'd listened to recordings of his addresses after he'd given them to make improvements for the next time. He worked and reworked drafts, so that by the time he sat down at the microphone, he'd committed his speech to memory. Before every address, he took a nap to rest his voice. He spoke at an unusual speed, much slower than most radio announcers, and with an everyday vocabulary. Roosevelt's mastery of the airwaves resulted from his talent for and dedication to the forum, but he also worked with his FCC chairman to block newspaper publishers from owning radio stations, thereby defeating William Randolph Hearst's attempt to expand his empire to radio and denying one of his key political opponents a place on the dial. Roosevelt was also dogged in his work with Congress. He met with legislators every day of the first 100 days of his administration and proposed, and Congress passed, a flurry of legislation intended to stabilize and reform the banking system, regulate the economy through government planning, provide economic relief through public assistance programs, reduce unemployment through a public works program, and allow farmers to keep their farms by securing better resources to rural Americans. "As a nation," Perkins said, "we are recognizing that programs long thought of as merely labor welfare, such as shorter hours, higher wages, and a voice in the terms and conditions of work, are really essential economic factors for recovery." Roosevelt's agenda rested on the idea that government planning was necessary for the recovery, and to some degree on the Keynesian belief that the remedy for depression was government spending, an agenda he adopted even before the publication in 1936 of Keynes's Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. FDR's banking reforms included the Emergency Banking Act, the Glass-Steagall Act, which established the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and creation of the Securities Exchange Commission. The Public Works Administration oversaw tens of thousands of infrastructure projects, from repairing roads to building dams, as well as cultural and arts initiatives, including the Federal Writers Project and the Federal Theater Project. The Agricultural Adjustment Act addressed the problems faced by the more than 1 in 3 Americans who worked on farms. FDR had dealt with many of these problems as governor of New York. During the 1920s, more than 300,000 farms in New York were abandoned. Like many reformers associated with what came to be called the New Conservation, Roosevelt believed the greatest disparity of wealth in the United States was between urban and rural Americans. Farming communities had worse schools, inadequate health care, and higher taxes. "Poor land makes poor people," he believed. "I want to build up the land as, in part at least, an insurance against future depressions," Roosevelt said in 1931, the year he established the New York Power Authority. The Agricultural Adjustment Act, the Farm Security Administration, and other agricultural initiatives extended a better and fairer distribution of resources like land, power, and water to a national scale. Much of the greatest distress among rural Americans was felt in the Cotton Belt, a part of the country that FDR called the nation's number one economic problem, the nation's problem, not merely the South's. Reform, relief, and recovery were the three legs of FDR's agenda. Early results were promising, but the Depression continued. When any prognosticator foretells the outcome of the acts of the New Deal, he is more or less of a guesser in this vale of tears, Charles Beard wrote in 1934. What is an outcome or a result? Is an outcome a result in 1936, 1950, or the year 2000? The New Deal had barely begun, but voters approved. Democrats fared well in the midterm elections, leading Roosevelt to push further. "Boys, this is our hour," his advisor Harry Hopkins said. "We've got to get everything we want, a works program, Social Security, wages and hours, everything, now or never." Or not quite everything. In 1934, Isaac Rubino, who'd fought for national health insurance during the 1910s, published The Quest for Security and urged FDR to include health care in the New Deal. But by now, the American Medical Association, which had favored Rubino's proposal before the war, had switched sides. Government meddling in medicine, the editor of the Journal of American Medical Association said, came down to a question of Americanism versus Sovietism. Even without universal health care, the scope of the New Deal was remarkable. In 1935, Congress passed the National Labor Relations Act, granting to workers the right to organize, and established the Works Progress Administration to hire millions of people who built roads and schools and hospitals, as well as artists and writers. Meanwhile, Perkins drafted the Social Security Act, passed by Congress later that spring. It established pensions, federal government assistance for fatherless families, and unemployment relief. Still, the reforms had limits. The liberal policymakers who created the welfare state in the 1930s were averse to relief as such. "The federal government," FDR said, "has no intention or desire to force upon the country or the unemployed themselves a system of relief which is repugnant to American ideals of individual self-reliance." And they were also squeamish about direct taxes, an aversion most manifest in the decision to fund the Social Security Act with an indirect tax on payroll. This allowed New Dealers to distinguish between old age and unemployment programs, cast as insurance, paid for by annuities created from payroll taxes, acting as insurance premiums, and poverty programs, like aid to dependent children's, cast as welfare. One legacy of this distinction was that Americans hostile to welfare seldom saw Social Security as part of it. Hunger, aching want, was the great scourge of the 1930s. The land itself had grown barren. "When we picked the cotton, we could see the tracks where we plowed 2 or 3 months before," Wills Magby recalled of the drought in beaten Arkansas, west of Little Rock. "Hadn't rained enough to wash away the tracks." Magby was 13 years old in 1933 when his parents piled him and his 6 younger siblings into an old Model T and drove from Arkansas to South Texas. The family slept on the ground at the side of the road, pawning the last of their scant belongings along the way to buy gasoline. Once in Texas, for weeks at a time, they ate nothing but cornmeal soaked in rainwater. One winter, they lived off rabbits. Only in 1936, when Magby's father was able to get a government loan to buy a team of mules and plant a crop, did things start to look up. Nearly 5 in 10 white families and 9 in 10 black families endured poverty at some point during the Depression. Black families fared worse not only because more fell into poverty, but also because the roads out of poverty were often closed to them. New Deal loan, relief, and insurance programs often specifically excluded black people. Louise Norton, born in Grenada in 1900, met her husband Earl Little, a Baptist minister, at a United Negro Improvement Association meeting in Philadelphia in 1917. In 1925, when the Littles were living in Omaha and Louise was pregnant with her son Malcolm and home alone with her 3 young children, mounted Klansmen came to their house, threatening to lynch the Reverend Little. Finding him not at home, they shattered all the windows. Driven out of Omaha, the Littles eventually settled in Lansing, Michigan, where still more vigilantes burned their home to the ground. In 1931, the Reverend Little was killed by a streetcar. Much evidence suggests that his death was not an accident. After Little's death, the insurance company denied his widow life insurance. For a while, Louise and the children lived on dandelions. In 1939, after giving birth to her 8th child, Louise Little was committed to an insane asylum at the Kalamazoo State Hospital, where she remained for the next quarter century. Her son Malcolm was moved into foster care, and then a juvenile home, and eventually lived in Boston with his half-sister, who would one day change his name to Malcolm X. Yet if hard times widened some divisions, they narrowed others. People who were doing fairly well one day could be reduced to anguished indigence the next. Then, too, it was impossible not to bear witness. Massive unemployment had this side effect. People had more time on their hands to listen to the radio. 1/3 of all movie theaters closed, but between 1935 and 1941 alone, nearly 300 new radio stations opened. By the end of the decade, the United States had more than half the world's radio sets, at a time when radio broadcasts chronicled and dramatized the suffering of the poor to a national audience, both in reporting and in the emerging genre of the radio drama, with a new vocabulary of sound effects, immediate and visceral. Much of the work of chronicling the suffering of those years was done by playwrights, photographers, historians, and writers, hired by the government under the auspices of the Works Progress Administration. Working for the Federal Writers Project and the Federal Theater Project, including its radio division, they documented the lives of the ordinary, the rural, and especially the poor, in interviews, photographs, films, paintings, and radio broadcasts. Its critics called it the whistle-piss-and-argue department, but at a time when one in four people in publishing were out of work, the WPA's Federal Writers Project provided employment to more than 7,000 writers, including Ralph Ellison, Zora Neale Hurston, John Cheever, and Richard Wright. But it was radio that brought the sounds of suffering into the homes, even, of the people who were still getting by, and even the rarer few who were prospering. James Truslow Adams's The Epic of America, 1931, featuring the lives of the humblest Americans, was dramatized by the Federal Theater of the Air. There is no lack of excellent one-volume narratives of the history of the United States in which the political, military, diplomatic, social, and economic strands have been skillfully interwoven, Adams had written in his book's preface. The Epic of America was not that kind of book. Instead, Adams had tried to discover for himself and others how the ordinary American, under which category most of us come, has become what he is today in outlook, character, and opinion. Adams, who'd wanted to call his book The American Dream, a term he coined, celebrated the struggles of the common man in language that would stir leaders of later generations, from Martin Luther King Jr. to Barack Obama. Much the same spirit pervaded the documentary projects of the WPA and of other New Deal programs, including the photography of Dorothea Lange and Walker Evans, undertaken on behalf of the Farm Security Administration. The head of the FSA's photography program required his staff to read Charles Beard's History of the United States, an eloquent and strident social history that championed the struggles of the poor. The WPA's folklore director, Benjamin Botkin, wanted to turn the streets, the stockyards, and the hiring halls into literature. From more than 10,000 interviews, the Writers Project produced some 800 books, including A Treasury of American Folklore and a volume called These Are Our Lives, which included excerpts from more than 2,000 interviews with Americans once held as slaves. If the Depression and alike the New Deal created a new compassion for the poor, it also produced a generation of politicians committed to the idea that government can relieve suffering and regulate the economy. In 1937, lanky former Texas schoolteacher Lyndon Baines Johnson was elected to Congress, where he worked to obtain federal funds for his district for projects like the construction of dams to improve farmland. When LBJ was a boy, his father had lost his farm. He'd grown up dirt poor. 6'3", with long ears and no discernible end to his energy, Johnson had hitchhiked to a state teacher's college, and after graduating, had taught in an elementary school in Cotulla, Texas, 60 miles north of the border. The students were Mexican-American. There was no lunch break because the children had no lunch to eat. Johnson organized a debating team and taught them how to fight for their ideas. When he ran for Congress, he printed signs that read, "Franklin D. and Lyndon B." Like his hero, LBJ embraced the radio, campaigning on radio stations like KNOW in Austin and KTSA in San Antonio, and once, in an act of inspired populist appeal, broadcasting from a barbershop. In Congress, Johnson regularly worked 16- and 18-hour days. He fought for the Bankhead-Jones Act in 1937 to help tenant farmers buy land. He campaigned for more improvements, too, and fought to have rural electrification placed in the hands not of power companies, but farmers' cooperatives. He later said, "We built 6 dams on our river. We brought the floods under control. We provided our people with cheap power. That all resulted from the power of the government to bring the greatest good to the greatest number." What was that number? New methods and new sources of information made it possible to measure the impact of the New Deal as the age of quantification yielded to the age of statistics. In 1912, an Italian statistician named Corrado Gini, chair of statistics at the University of Cagliari, devised what came to be called the Gini Index, which measures economic inequality on a scale from 0 to 1. If all the income in the world were earned by one person and everyone else earned nothing, the world would have a Gini Index of 1. If everyone in the world earned exactly the same income, the world would have a Gini index of 0. In between 0 and 1, the higher the number, the greater the gap between the rich and the poor. Using federal income tax returns filed beginning in 1913, it's possible to calculate the Gini Index for the United States. In 1928, under the tax scheme endorsed by Secretary of Treasury Andrew Mellon, the top 1% of American families earned 24% of all income. By 1938, after the reforms of the New Deal, the top 1% of American families earned only 16% of all income. It was just this kind of redistribution at a time when Americans were flirting with fascism that alarmed conservatives. The sort of economic planning that Gini himself advocated was closely associated with non-democratic states. In 1925, 4 years after he wrote an essay called The Measurement of Inequality, Gini signed the Manifesto of Fascist Intellectuals. His work as a scientist was so closely tied to the fascist state that after the regime fell, he was tried for being an apologist for fascism. Americans, too, had begun hunting for apologists for fascism, and especially for communism, fishing for American subversives. During the Depression, some 75,000 Americans had joined the Communist Party. In May 1938, Martin Dies, Jr., a beefy 37-year-old conservative Democrat from Texas and a fly in Lyndon Johnson's eye, convened the House Un-American Activities Committee to investigate suspected communists and communist organizations. Dorothy Thompson railed against the committee. Little men, nasty little men who run around pinning tags on people. This one is a red, and this one is a Jew. Since when has America become a race of snoopers? But the snooping had been going on for a while. Much of Dies' work continued the campaign of harassment and intimidation waged by J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, which had for years been conducting surveillance on hundreds of black artists and writers, infiltrating their organizations, and in particular, harassing writers and artists of the Harlem Renaissance. As Richard Wright wrote in FBI Blues, "Everywhere I look, Lord, I see FBIs. I'm getting sick and tired of government spies." In congressional hearings, Dies directed his ire at writers and artists employed by the WPA, attempting to demonstrate that their work, their plays and poems and folklore collections and documentary photographs, contain hidden communist messages. In one notorious encounter, Dies called Hallie Flanagan, the director of the Federal Theater Project. Flanagan, born in South Dakota, was an accomplished playwright and distinguished professor of drama at Vassar, where she'd founded its experimental theater. When she appeared before Dies' committee in December 1938, Alabama Congressman Joseph Starnes asked her about a scholarly article she'd written in which she'd used the phrase "Marlowe-esque madness." The theater project had funded productions of Marlowe's The Tragical History of Dr. Faustus in New Orleans, Boston, Detroit, and Atlanta, and, directed by Orson Welles, in New York. "You are quoting from this Marlowe," Starnes said. "Is he a communist?" Spectators roared with laughter. But Flanagan answered solemnly, "I was quoting from Christopher Marlowe." "Tell us who Marlowe is," Starnes pressed. "Put in the record," Flanagan said wearily, "that he was the greatest dramatist in the period of Shakespeare." Flanagan was right to be worried. The Federal Theater Project had staged more than 800 plays. Dies' committee objected to only a handful, including Woman of Destiny, about a female president, and Machine Age, about mass production. But months after Flanagan's testimony, funding for both the Federal Theater Project and the Federal Writers Project stopped, Congress having struck a bargain with Dies, little better than the deal Faustus struck with Lucifer. 3. Franklin Roosevelt's presidency marked the beginning of a New Deal order, an American-led, rights-based liberalism that Lyndon Johnson would carry into the 1960s. In the 19th century, liberalism meant advocacy of laissez-faire capitalism. The meaning of the word changed during the Progressive Era, when self-styled progressives, borrowing from populism, began attempting to reform laissez-faire capitalism by using the tools of collective action and appeals to the people adopted by populists. In the 1930s, these efforts came together as New Deal liberalism. All that while, a new kind of conservatism was growing, too. It consisted not only of businessmen who opposed government regulation of the economy, but also of Americans, chiefly rural Americans, who objected to government interference in their lives. These two strands of conservatism were largely separate in the 1930s, but they'd already begun moving closer, especially in their animosity toward the paternalism of liberalism. Not long into FDR's first term, businessmen who had supported him began to question his agenda. The DuPont brothers, Pierre, Irénée, and Lamont, belonged to a family that had made its fortune in paints, plastics, and munitions. In 1934, Merchants of Death, a bestseller that blamed arms manufacturers for the First World War, led to a congressional investigation headed by North Dakota Republican Senator Gerald P. Nye, who'd flouted his party to support Roosevelt. At the time, concern about munitions manufacturers crossed party lines, and so did a related concern about guns. Americans had always owned guns, but states had also always regulated their manufacture, ownership, and storage. Carrying concealed weapons was prohibited by laws in Kentucky and Louisiana, 1813, Indiana, 1820, Tennessee and Virginia, 1838, Alabama, 1839, and Ohio, 1859. Texas, Florida, and Oklahoma passed similar laws. "The mission of a concealed deadly weapon is murder," said one governor of Texas. "To check it is the duty of every self-respecting, law-abiding man." Different rules obtained in the city and in the country. In western cities and towns, sheriffs routinely collected the guns of visitors, like checked baggage. In 1873, a sign in Wichita, Kansas read, "Leave your revolvers at police headquarters and get a check." On the road to Dodge, a billboard read, "The carrying of firearms strictly prohibited." The shootout at the OK Corral in Tombstone, Arizona, happened when Wyatt Earp confronted a man violating an 1879 city ordinance by failing to leave his gun at the sheriff's office. The National Rifle Association had been founded in 1871 by a former reporter from the New York Times as a sporting and hunting association. Most of its business consisted of sponsoring target shooting competitions. Not only did the NRA not oppose firearms regulation, it supported and even sponsored it. In the 1920s and 1930s, the era of Nye's Munitions Committee, the NRA endorsed gun control legislation, lobbying for new state laws in the 1920s and 1930s. Concern about urban crime led to federal legislation in the 1930s. Public safety-minded firearms regulation was uncontroversial. The NRA supported both the Uniform 1934 National Firearms Act, the first federal gun control legislation, and the 1938 Federal Firearms Act, which together prohibitively taxed the private ownership of automatic weapons, machine guns, mandated licensing for handgun dealers, introduced waiting periods for handgun buyers, required permits for anyone wishing to carry a concealed weapon, and created a licensing system for dealers. In 1939, in a unanimous decision in U.S. versus Miller, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld these measures after FDR's Solicitor General, Robert H. Jackson, argued that the Second Amendment is restricted to the keeping and bearing of arms by the people collectively for their common defense and security. The text of the amendment, Jackson argued, makes clear that the right is not one which may be utilized for private purposes, but only one which exists where the arms are borne in the militia or some other military organization provided for by law and intended for the protection of the state. The 1934 and 1938 firearms legislation enjoyed bipartisan support, but the regulation of munitions manufacturing was more usually promoted by conservatives who were isolationists. For 2 years, Nye, railing against merchants of death, led the most rigorous inquiry into the arms industry that any branch of the federal government has ever conducted. He convened 93 hearings. He thought that the ability to manufacture weapons should be restricted to the government. The removal of the element of profit from war would materially remove the danger of more war, he said. From the vantage of the DuPonts, the prospect of handing the manufacture of weapons over to the government represented the worst possible instance of laissez-faire economics yielding to a planned economy. The DuPonts were concerned, too, about the growing strength of labor unions, the number of strikes, and the establishment of the Securities Exchange Commission. Irenée DuPont wrote, "It must have now become clear to every thinking man that the so-called New Deal advocated by the administration is nothing more or less than the socialist doctrine called by another name." To make this case to the American public, the DuPonts turned to the National Association of Manufacturers, whose president said, "The public does not understand industry, largely because industry itself has made no real effort to tell its story, to show the people of this country that our high living standards have risen almost altogether from the civilization which industrial activity has set up." To that end, the association hired a publicist named Walter W. Weisenberger, appointing him executive vice president. Weisenberger used the tools of radio and paid advertisement to oppose both labor agitation and government regulation, by arguing that peace and prosperity were best assured by the leadership of businessmen and a free market. One campaign motto, "Prosperity dwells where harmony reigns." The association insisted that its efforts were educational, but a congressional investigation led by Wisconsin progressive Robert M. La Follette concluded otherwise. Business leaders, the La Follette Committee reported, asked not what the weaknesses and abuses of the economic structure had been and how they could be corrected, but instead paid millions to tell the public that nothing was wrong and that grave dangers lurked in proposed remedies. Other corporate leaders pursued similar aims. In July 1934, the DuPonts gathered fellow businessmen in the offices of General Motors in New York, where they founded a property holders association to oppose the New Deal. By August, this association had been incorporated as the American Liberty League. In pamphlets and in speeches, the League argued that the voice of business was being drowned out by the ravenous madness of the New Deal. Leaguers particularly objected to Social Security, described as the taking of property without due process of law. The majority of the League's funding came from only 30 very wealthy men. Democrats dubbed it the Millionaires' Union. It went by other names, too. In the U.S. presidential election of 1936, the Liberty League supported the Republican nominee Alf M. Landon, an oil executive and governor of Kansas, through the efforts of an organization called the Farmers Independence Council. But the Farmers Independence Council had the same mailing address as the Liberty League, and a membership that consisted not of any farmers, but instead of Chicago meatpackers. Most of his funding came from Lamont DuPont, who defended his lobbying as a farmer by insisting that his ownership of a 4,000-acre estate made him one. Many kinds of conservatism coexisted in the United States in the 1930s, not yet sharing an ideology. Businessmen who opposed the New Deal generally had little in common with conservative intellectuals, like Albert J. Nock, editor of a magazine called The Freeman, and author of Our Enemy, the State, 1935. While he complained about a centralized state, Nock was chiefly concerned with the rise of mass democracy and mass culture as harbingers of the decline of Western civilization, believing that radical egalitarianism had produced a world of mediocrity and blandness. American conservative intellectuals were opposed to socialism. They were isolationists. Many tended to be anti-Semitic. In 1941, Nock wrote an essay for the Atlantic Monthly called The Jewish Problem in America. Only after the war would the conservative movement find its base and its direction. Meanwhile, the leftward drift of American politics in the 1930s was kept in check by the new businesses of political consulting and public opinion polling, the single most important forces in American democracy since the rise of the party system. Campaigns, Inc., the first political consulting firm in the history of the world, was founded by Clem Whitaker and Leon Baxter in California in 1933. Critics called it the lie factory. Political consulting is often thought of as a product of the advertising industry, but the reverse is closer to the truth. When modern advertising began in the 1920s, the industry's big clients were interested in advancing a political agenda as much as, if not more than, a commercial one. Muckrakers and congressional investigations tended to make Standard Oil look greedy, and DuPont, for making munitions, sinister. Large corporations hired advertising firms to make themselves look better and to advance pro-business legislation. Political consulting's origins in journalism lie with William Randolph Hearst. Whitaker, 34, started out as a newspaperman, or really a newspaper boy. He was already working as a reporter at the age of 13. By 19, he was city editor for the Sacramento Union, and 2 years later, a political writer for the San Francisco Examiner, a Hearst paper. In the 1930s, 1 in 4 Americans got their news from Hearst, who owned 28 newspapers in 19 cities. Hearst's papers were all alike, hot-blooded, with leggy headlines. Page 1 was supposed to make a reader blurt out, "Gee whiz!" Page 2, "Holy Moses!" Page 3, "God Almighty!" Hearst used his newspapers to advance his politics. In 1934, he ordered his editors to send reporters to college campuses posing as students to find out which members of the faculty were Reds. People Hearst thought were communists not infrequently thought Hearst was a fascist. He'd professed his admiration for Hitler and Mussolini. Hearst didn't mind. He silenced his critics by attacking them in his papers, relentlessly and ferociously. Some fought back. "Only cowards are intimidated by Hearst," Charles Beard said. In February 1935, Beard addressed an audience of 1,000 school teachers in Atlantic City and said of Hearst, "No person with intellectual honesty or moral integrity will touch him with a 10-foot pole." The crowd gave Beard a standing ovation. Hearst endures in American culture in Citizen Kane, a film by Orson Welles released in 1941. The film bears so uncanny a resemblance to Imperial Hearst, a biography of Hearst published in 1936, with a preface by Beard, that the biographer sued the filmmakers. "I have never seen or heard of the book Imperial Hearst," Wells insisted in a deposition for a case that was eventually settled out of court. Wells argued that his Citizen Kane wasn't a character. He was a type. An American Sultan. The film was originally titled American. If Kane, like Hearst, was a newspaper tycoon who turned to politics, that's because, according to Wells, such men as Kane always tend toward the newspaper and entertainment world. Despite hating the audience they crave, combating a morbid preoccupation with the public with a devastatingly low opinion of the public mentality and moral character. Combining a morbid preoccupation with the public with a devastatingly low opinion of the public mentality and moral character. A man like Kane, Wells said, believes that politics as the means of communication and indeed the nation itself is all there for his personal pleasuring. Hearst would not be the last American Sultan. Clem Whitaker, having been trained by Hearst, left the San Francisco Examiner to start a newspaper wire service, the Capital News Bureau, distributing stories to over 80 papers. In 1933, Sheridan Downey, a progressive California lawyer originally from Wyoming, hired Whitaker to help him defeat a referendum sponsored by Pacific Gas and Electric. Downey also hired Leon Baxter, a 26-year-old widow who had been a writer for the Portland Oregonian, and suggested that she and Whitaker join forces. When Whitaker and Baxter defeated the referendum, Pacific Gas and Electric was so impressed that it put the two on retainer, and Whitaker and Baxter, who later married, started doing business as Campaigns, Inc. Campaigns, Inc. specialized in running political campaigns for businesses, especially monopolies like Standard Oil and Pacific Telephone and Telegraph. Working for the left-wing Downey had been an aberration. As a friend said, they like to work the right side of the street. In 1933, Upton Sinclair, an eccentric and dizzyingly prolific writer still best known for The Jungle, his 1906 muckraking indictment of the meatpacking industry, decided to run for governor of California. Sinclair, a longtime socialist, registered as a Democrat in order to seek the Democratic nomination on a platform known as EPIC, End Poverty in California. After he unexpectedly won the nomination, he chose Downey as his running mate. Their ticket was called Uppy and Downey. Sinclair saw American history as a battle between business and democracy, and so far, he wrote, big business has won every skirmish. Emboldened by Roosevelt's winning of the White House, Sinclair decided to take a shot at the governor's office. Whitaker and Baxter, like most California Republicans, were horrified at the prospect of a Sinclair governorship. 2 months before the election, they began working for George Hatfield, a candidate for a lieutenant governor, on a Republican ticket headed by the incumbent governor, Frank Merriam. They locked themselves in a room for 3 days with everything Sinclair had ever written. Upton was beaten, Whitaker later said, because he had written books. The Los Angeles Times began running on its front page a box with an Upton Sinclair quotation in it, a practice the paper continued every day for 6 weeks right up to Election Day. For instance, Sinclair on marriage. The sanctity of marriage. I have had such a belief. I have it no longer. The passage, as Sinclair explained in a book called I, Candidate for Governor and How I Got Licked, was taken from his novel Love's Pilgrimage, 1911, in which a fictional character writes a heartbroken letter to a man having an affair with his wife. Reading those boxes day after day, Sinclair wrote, I made up my mind that the election was lost. The nation was founded on self-evident truths, but as Sinclair argued, voters were now being led by a lie factory. I was told they had a dozen men searching libraries and reading every word I had ever published, he wrote. They'd find lines he'd written, speeches of fictional characters and novels, and stick them in the paper as if Sinclair had said them. They had an especially happy time with the prophets of religion, Sinclair said, referring to his 1917 polemic about institutionalized religion. I received many letters from agitated old ladies and gentlemen on the subject of my blasphemy. Do you believe in God? Asked one. There was very little he could do about it. They had a staff of political chemists at work, preparing poisons to be let loose in the California atmosphere on every one of 100 mornings. Sure, those quotations were irrelevant, Baxter later said. But we had one objective, to keep him from becoming governor. They succeeded. The final vote was Merriam, 1,138,000, Sinclair, 879,000. No development altered the workings of American democracy, so wholly as the industry Whitaker and Baxter founded. Every voter a consumer, every consumer a voter, became its mantra. They succeeded best by being noticed least. Progressive reformers dismantled the party machine, but New Dealers barely noticed when political consultants replaced party bosses, as the wielders of political power gained not by votes, but by money. Whitaker and Baxter won nearly every campaign they waged. The campaigns they chose to run and the way they decided to run them shaped the history of California and of the country. They drafted the rules by which campaigns would be waged for decades afterward. The first thing they did when they took on a campaign was to hibernate for a week to write a plan of campaign. Then they wrote an opposition plan of campaign to anticipate the moves made against them. Every campaign needs a theme. Keep it simple. Rhyming's good. For Jimmy and me, vote yes on three. Never explain anything. The more you have to explain, Whitaker said, the more difficult it is to win support. Say the same thing over and over again. We assume we have to get a voter's attention 7 times to make a sale, Whitaker said. Subtlety is your enemy. Words that lean on the mind are no good, according to Baxter. They must dent it. Simplify, simplify, simplify. A wall goes up, Whitaker warned, when you try to make Mr. and Mrs. Average American Citizen work or think. Make it personal, Whitaker and Baxter always advised. Candidates are easier to sell than issues. If your position doesn't have an opposition, or if your candidate doesn't have an opponent, invent one. Once, when fighting an attempt to recall the mayor of San Francisco, Whitaker and Baxter waged a campaign against the faceless man, the idea was Baxter's, who might end up replacing him. Baxter drew a picture on a tablecloth of a fat man with a cigar poking out from beneath a face hidden by a hat, and then had him plastered on billboards all over the city with the question, "Who's behind the recall?" Pretend that you are the voice of the people. Whitaker and Baxter bought radio ads sponsored by the Citizens Committee Against the Recall, in which an ominous voice said, "The real issue is whether City Hall is to be turned over lock, stock, and barrel to an unholy alliance fronting for a faceless man." The recall was defeated. "Attack, attack, attack," said Whitaker. "You can't wage a defensive campaign and win." Never underestimate the opposition. Never shy from controversy, they advised. Instead, win the controversy. "The average American," Whitaker wrote, "doesn't want to be educated. He doesn't want to improve his mind. He doesn't even want to work, consciously, at being a good citizen. But there are 2 ways you can interest him in a campaign, and only 2 that we have found successful. You can put on a fight. He likes a good hot battle with no punches pulled. Or you can put on a show. He likes the movies. He likes mysteries. He likes fireworks and parades. So if you can't fight, put on a show. And if you put on a good show, Mr. and Mrs. America will turn out to see it." Whitaker and Baxter, more effectively than any politician, addressed the problem of mass democracy with an elegant solution. They turned politics into a business. But their very success depended, in part, on the rise of another political industry, public opinion polling. The American public opinion industry began as democracy's answer to fascist propaganda. By the end of 1933, Joseph Goebbels had established a broadcasting division within his Ministry of Propaganda and had undertaken production of cheap radio sets, the Volksempfänger, or people's sets, with an aim of ensuring that the government could reach every household, in a practice Goebbels liked to describe as mind-bombing. Fascists told the people what to believe, Democrats asked them. But the scientific measurement of public opinion would come to rest on its ability to accurately predict the outcome of elections. From the start, the industry embraced a paradox. Publicly and reliably predicting the outcome of an election would seem to undercut democracy, not promote it. Notwithstanding this paradox, polling proceeded. Newspapers had been predicting local election results for decades, but predicting the outcome of a national election required a network of newspapers. In 1904, the New York Herald, the Cincinnati Inquirer, the Chicago Record Herald, and the St. Louis Republic joined forces to forecast elections, tallying their straws together. By 1916, the Herald had organized a group of newspapers in 36 states. That year, the Literary Digest, a national magazine, began mailing out ballots as a publicity stunt. The Digest used its polls to attract new subscribers. Its plan was to collect more ballots than anyone else. In 1920, the Digest distributed 11 million ballots, and in 1924, more than 16 million. For reach, its only real rival was the chain of newspapers owned by William Randolph Hearst, which was able to report the results of polls in 43 states. Although the Literary Digest sometimes miscalculated the popular vote, it always got the Electoral College winner right. In 1924, the Digest forecast was right for all but 2 states, and in 1928, for all but 4. A newspaper man named Emil Hurria figured out that this method was nevertheless bound to fail, since what matters is not the size of a stack of straws, but its variety. Hurria tried to convince the Democratic National Committee to conduct its own straw polls using ore sampling methods. In mining, you take several samples from the face of the ore, pulverize them, and find out what the average pay per ton will be, Hurria explained. In politics, you take sections of voters, check new trends against past performances, establish percentage shift among different voting strata, supplement this information from competent observers in the field, and you can accurately predict an election. In 1928, the DNC dismissed Hurria as a crank, but by 1932, he was running FDR's campaign. The Literary Digest mailing list had grown to more than 20 million names. Most of those names were taken from telephone directories and automobile registration files. Hurria was one of the few people who understood that the Digest had consistently underestimated FDR's support because its sample, while very big, was not very representative. People who supported FDR were much less likely than the rest of the population to own a telephone or a car. Hurria was borrowing from the insights of social science. But the real innovation in public opinion measurement was a method that had been devised by social scientists in the 1920s, which was to use statistics to estimate the opinions of a vast population by surveying a statistically representative sample. Political polling is the marriage of journalism and social science, a marriage made by George Gallup. "When I went to college, I wanted to study journalism and later go out and be an editor of a newspaper," Gallup said, remembering his days at the University of Iowa in the 1920s. "But in my day, I couldn't get a degree in journalism, so I got my degree in psychology." He graduated in 1923, entered a graduate program in the new field, applied psychology, where everyone was talking about Walter Lippmann's 1922 book, Public Opinion, and Gallup got interested in the problem of measuring it. His first idea was to use the sample survey to understand how people read the news. In 1928, in a dissertation called An Objective Method for Determining Reader Interest in the Content of a Newspaper, he argued that at one time the press was depended upon as the chief agency for instructing and informing the mass of people, but that the growth of public schools meant that newspapers no longer filled that role, and instead ought to meet a greater need for entertainment. He therefore devised a method to measure reader interest, a way to know what parts of the paper readers found entertaining. He called it the Iowa method. It consists of chiefly going through a newspaper column by column with a reader of the paper. The interviewer would then mark up the newspaper to show what parts the reader had enjoyed. The Iowa method offers the newspaper editor a scientific means for fitting his paper to his community, Gallup wrote. He could hire an expert in measurement to conduct a study to find out what features and writers his readers liked best, and then stop printing the boring stuff. In 1932, when Gallup was a professor of journalism at Northwestern, his mother-in-law, Ola Babcock Miller, ran for lieutenant governor of Iowa. Her husband had died in office. Her nomination was largely honorary, and she was not expected to win. Gallup decided to apply his ideas about measuring reader interest to understanding her chances. After that, he moved to New York and began working for an advertising agency, where, while also teaching at Columbia, he perfected a method for measuring the size of a radio audience. He conducted some experiments in 1933 and 1934, trying to figure out how to better predict elections for newspapers and magazines, and started a company he named the Editor's Research Bureau. Gallup liked to call public opinion measurement a new field of journalism, but he decided his work needed a scholarly pedigree. In 1935, he renamed the Editor's Research Bureau the American Institute of Public Opinion and established it at Princeton, New Jersey, which also made it sound more academic. Gallup's method was to survey public opinion by asking questions of a sample of the population carefully chosen to represent the whole of it. He said he was taking the pulse of democracy, wrote a skeptical E.B. White. "Although you can take a nation's pulse, you can't be sure the nation hasn't just run up a flight of stairs." In 1935, to announce the publication of a new weekly column by Gallup, the Washington Post launched a blimp over the nation's capital, trailing a streamer that read, "America Speaks!" Gallup intended the measurement of public opinion to be a tool for democratic government, a tool intended to do the very opposite of the work of political consulting. Political consulting is the business of managing the opinion of the masses. Public opinion surveying is the business of finding out the opinions of the masses. Political consultants tell voters what to think, pollsters ask them what they think. But neither of these businesses gives a great deal of credit to the idea that voters ought to make independent judgments, or that they can. New industries, new technologies, and the conduct of the war itself heightened long-standing concerns about the power of propaganda. Joseph Goebbels, who had completed his PhD in 1921, had been greatly influenced by Edward Bernays and used the methods of American public relations in broadcasting messages by print, radio, film, and parades. Goebbels had a device installed in his office that allowed him to preempt national programming, and he deployed radio wardens to make sure Germans were listening to official broadcasts. The purpose of fascist propaganda is to control the opinions of the masses and deploy them in the service of the power of the state. Germans had attempted to employ Bernays himself. He refused. But other American public relations firms had accepted commissions to produce pro-Nazi propaganda in the United States. Goebbels hoped to sow division in the United States, partly through a short-wave radio system, the Weltrundfunksender, or World Broadcasting Station, the propaganda ministry's long-range propaganda artillery. By 1934, it was broadcasting pro-Germany English and foreign language propaganda to Africa, Latin America, the Far East, Southeast Asia, Indonesia, and Australia, though its broadcasts to North America far outstripped the scale of all of its other programs. To the United States, where it broadcast in American English, the Weltrundfunksender sent false news, chiefly having to do with claims about a communist Jewish conspiracy. Newspapers took to calling this sort of thing fake news. But some Americans worried that not much separated fake news from the work of Whitaker and Baxter's Lie Factory, or even from the forms of political persuasion deployed by the White House. Roosevelt's critics accused him of adapting the radio for purposes of propaganda. The Democratic National Committee's executive secretary talked about voters in much the same way as Whitaker and Baxter did. "The average American's mind works simply, and it is not hard to keep him behind the president if we can properly inform him as to what is going on in Washington, what the president is trying to do, and specific objectives he is seeking." This was best done, the DNC secretary pointed out, from a source of confidence like the radio. But in contrast to Europe, the government in the United States neither owned nor in the end controlled the radio. And nothing in FDR's arsenal of persuasion came close to the deception practiced on voters by the nation's first political consultants. Still, even Roosevelt's closest allies worried. Felix Frankfurter, an advisor to the president and longtime friend of Walter Lippmann's, they'd lived together in the House of Truth, warned Roosevelt to keep clear of public relations professionals, calling men like Bernays professional poisoners of the public mind, exploiters of foolishness, fanaticism, and self-interest. FDR, though, was drawn not to Bernays, but to Gallup. He trimmed his sails by the Daily Voter Mail, and more by the weekly polls. Roosevelt was willing to use broad executive powers to accomplish his agenda, but not without popular support. With FDR, polling entered the White House and the American political process, and there it remained. 4. On June 27, 1936, Roosevelt accepted his party's nomination at the University of Pennsylvania's Franklin Field before a crowd of 100,000. "This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny," he said. The United States was now fighting to save democracy, both for ourselves and for the world. Saving democracy at home required dismantling Jim Crow. This Roosevelt did not do. Jim Crow defined New Deal politics. Between violence, poll taxes, literacy tests, and other forms of disenfranchisement, less than 4% of African Americans were registered to vote. Nevertheless, the revenge of the slave is to place his masters in such subjection that they can make no decision, political, social, economic, or ethical, without reference to him. Ann O'Hare McCormick wrote in 1930, "Voteless, he dominates politics." FDR's reliance on public opinion surveys made this problem worse. Gallup's early method is known as quota sampling. He analyzed the electorate to determine what proportion of the people who vote are men, women, black, white, young, and old. The people who conducted his surveys had to fill a quota so that the survey respondents would constitute an exactly proportionate mini-electorate. But what Gallup presented to the American public as public opinion was the opinion of Americans who were disproportionately wealthy, white, and male. Nationwide, in the 1930s and 1940s, blacks constituted about 10% of the population, but made up less than 2% of Gallup's survey group. Because blacks in the South generally could not vote, Gallup assigned no Negro quota in those states. Instead of representing American public opinion, polling essentially silenced the voices of African Americans. Roosevelt's electoral coalition drew African Americans from the Republican Party. He consulted an informal group of advisors who came to be called his Black Cabinet, and he appointed the first African-American federal judge. But New Deal programs were generally segregated, and Roosevelt failed to act to oppose lynching. After 23 lynchings in 1933, anti-lynching legislation was introduced into Congress. The next year, a man named Claude Neal, accused of rape and murder, was taken from a jail in Alabama and brought to Florida, where he was tortured, mutilated, and executed before 4,000 spectators. In the Senate, Southern Democrats waged a filibuster against the anti-lynching bill.